Okay, questions for this evening. Da-da-da.
Yes, thank you so much. Oh, here come the questions. Number one, can you please talk about Bodhinyana International Foundation? How is it set up? And the website to Google Sadhu for that? Oh, that's, well look, you know that you have to get Buddhism to actually to fit into the modern age. And so we have in our modern age something we call franchising. So KFC just started with one little store, now it's worldwide. So Bodhinyana just started with one little monastery, and now we have Bodhinyana International Foundations. Soon there'll be a Bodhinyana monastery in a suburb close to you. Wouldn't that be nice? Now what happened is a group of disciples in Hong Kong, so you know, I've been going over there for a long time now, and they decided to make it a bit more formal, to have some society or some sort of group so they can organize all the talks and the teachings and everything else. So they called it Bodhinyana International Foundation, or in short, BIF. Because in Australia, BIF means punching somebody. But it is the BIF Foundation. So I don't know if it's on the website what it is. It's only a small group of people, but it's just my franchise in Hong Kong. Dear Ajahn, did the devas mentioned in the Buddhist text come from Brahma world or some other godly realm? Were they enlightened beings? Can human be reborn in those realms? Now this is a nice question, because the devas, they can come from many different realms. And some of those realms, yes, they did come from very high realms, from the non-returner realm. And that's why some great little stories there of monks, or like two sort of people who came from the non-returner realms. And the first of those was a person which they usually call these days Sahampati. And they call him a Brahma, but he was actually from the Anagami realms, because Sahampati was also a monk with Jyotipala, the monk, and under the time of Kassapa the Buddha. And that's actually mentioned in the suttas. So, in a previous time when there was a previous Buddha, now it's not just this Buddha, we have had Buddhas before, we have Buddhas afterwards. But the previous Buddha to Gautama was Kassapa. And Kassapa had a number of disciples. Two of those monk disciples were Sahampati, I think it was called Upaka, I think, in his time before, and Jyotipala. And, you know, Jyotipala, you know, these are good friends, you know, meditating under Kassapa the Buddha. And Jyotipala, in a future life, was born as a young kid called Siddhartha, of the family Gautama. That was our Buddha. He was a monk under Kassapa the Buddha before. And one of his friends was, I think it was called Upaka, I could get that name wrong, and that was Sahampati. And so, once the Buddha became, you know, Gautama Buddha became our Buddha, Sahampati came around to congratulate him. And also to remind him, please don't just sit there and just bliss out in meditation, now's the time for you to teach. So Sahampati, who, you know, made that request to the Buddha, you know, please teach. There are some with little dust in their eyes. They couldn't have been from Beijing, because in Beijing, and Indonesia as well, there's lots of dust over there now, the forest fires. But in other countries, there's people with little dust in their eyes. So please teach for the benefit of the happiness of everybody. So that's where he went off to teach. And that's Sahampati, he was a mate of, you know, the Buddha in a previous life. As was the other person who came, one of the other people, the devas who came to see the Buddha under the Bodhi tree after his enlightenment. And that was Gatikara. And Gatikara, he was Jyotipala's best friend in the time of Kassapa the Buddha. And I've mentioned this many times to you before. Gatikara Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. It just really makes you understand what bodhisattvas really are. People before they become a Buddha. And Gatikara was a potter. He was a non-returner, disciple of Kassapa the Buddha. And his best friend was Jyotipala. And Jyotipala didn't want anything to do with any type of religion at all. Especially those bald-headed, good-for-nothings, calling themselves, you know, Buddhas. And this was Jyotipala, who actually said rotten things, bad words about Kassapa the Buddha. Until Gatikara tricked his friends just to come and see Kassapa the Buddha. And as soon as Jyotipala saw Kassapa the Buddha, he got so much faith and inspiration, he became a monk. And that was the Buddha in his previous life. Check it out, Gatikara Sutta. And Gatikara was one of the other devas who came down to see his old friend, you know, Jyotipala, said, we were in the same village in the previous life. You know, I was an Anagami, so I got reborn in the Anagami realm. You know, you got reborn as Siddhartha Gautama, now you're the Buddha. Congratulations, well done. We were best of friends before. That makes it very beautiful. I really like this. Those are devas. You know, who came to go and congratulate the Buddha. And sometimes they're from the Anagami realm. Sometimes they're all sorts of other realms as well. So yes, there are devas in the Buddhist texts. They come from the Brahma world. Sometimes they call that the Brahma world. That's why answered. They call it Brahma Sahampati, because it's the Anagami realm. But, you know, sometimes the way they use these words is, sometimes they call them Brahmas, sometimes they just call them devas. But there are many deva realms. And they're not fully enlightened beings. In that Anagami realm, they are, you know, non-returners. Very close to being fully enlightened. Only a tiny bit left. And can humans be reborn in those realms? Of course they were, because those people were humans before. So yes, you can. So is that answering the question okay? Okay. Dear Ajahn, what will happen if the planet Earth is smashed by an asteroid? Or eaten by the sun once it becomes a red giant? Will all beings be liberated? Will they be reborn in another galaxy? Or at the end of the Dhamma? Now I did tell you not to think about the future. This is what happens when you've got nothing to do. So just wait and see. When it happens, then you'll find out. So look, the Buddha actually said there are other planets. There are other beings in this great universe. So actually 2500 years ago the Buddha said, yeah, there are aliens. And I know there are aliens because I've been to Heathrow Airport and I've seen a channel that says up there, you know, EU citizens, you go to one channel, and aliens, you go to another channel. It says it there, I've seen it. So I never saw any aliens going through, but it did say a channel for aliens. Isn't that correct? Yeah, it is. So they have aliens there somewhere. And actually, we were just watching a couple of weeks ago, somebody said, so you have to watch these YouTube things about aliens. And apparently, sort of, you know, the people in the know say there are four different species of aliens. And one of them, what's the other one's called? No, one of them is called, absolutely true, this is what I said, the Nordic Blondes. And they are indistinguishable from people from Norway and Sweden. We've got one over in Bodhidharma Monastery, Ajahn Brahmali. I always was very suspicious. Now I know. He's an alien. So anyway, there's all sorts of stuff about aliens. But anyway. Look. The answer to the question is, this is not the only realm of existence, and even if everybody dies here, there's other places you can get reborn into. So don't worry, there's, you know, you're not going to disappear that easy. Dear Ajahn, when my body is relaxed and comfortable, oh, it's a sensible question for us to change. When my body is relaxed and comfortable, I am able to get into deeper states of meditation. However, if I have any discomfort or tightness, and I put my energy towards this, We don't understand how to let go of the body when it's not fully at ease. Metta, that's a good question. Because it's true, if your body's not at ease, it's very difficult to let it go. And this is one of the reasons why, you know, I kept on telling you at the beginning of this retreat, sleep enough, just rest, find a comfortable position, look after your body. It makes it much easier. It's not impossible to let go of the body when you're in discomfort. I mentioned, I think this morning, just or yesterday evening, when I had typhus fever. I could let go of the body and get into nice meditation or being bitten by mosquitoes. You know, you weren't comfortable at all, but you could still let go of the body, because now I'm a professional meditator. But it's much easier, you know, if your body is comfortable. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, the Buddha, before he became enlightened, this is Mahasatika Sutta number 36 of the Middle Leg Sayings, when he thought he hadn't got anywhere because his body was too tight and too hurting with all the ascetic practices, and then he thought, I'm getting nowhere. And he remembered the time as a young boy under the rose apple tree when he got into a jhana, and he thought, maybe that is the way to become enlightened. And the insight came, yes, that is the way to get enlightened. But how can someone with this weak, tired, painful body get into such states? It's difficult, he said, to get into such deep states with a weak and tired body. So I will eat, I will rest, I will bathe, which he did. And then when his body was at ease, he sat under the Bodhi tree. And then after he became enlightened, the first thing he taught to his first five disciples was middle way. Try and get the body so it's actually the middle way. One of the extremes is called Atta-Gilamata-Anu-Yoga. And Anu-Yoga means, you know, the practices, you know, the sorts of things you do. And Atta-Gilamata means things which tire the body, which weaken it. Those are the ones, he said, don't do that. So you have to have like a strong, energetic or comfortable body at the very least. Which is why you've got nice beds, why you've got your own en-suites, why you've got great food from all the people who come here, why you have cheese and chocolate and all sorts of other stuff in the evening. We'd really try to make it comfortable for you, because that is important. That's the middle way. And I don't know why it is that some people, they always think, no, this is too soft. If you're going to be enlightened, you have to be a tough guy. No namby-pamby cream puffs ever get enlightened. You've got to sit on broken glass for 6 hours without moving. And if you move, you're going to miss the opportunity to become enlightened. Even though your blood dries up and your bones turn to dust, I'm not going to move. Have you tried that? I tried that once. I lasted 45 minutes and I was in agony. That was when I was starting meditating. That is not how you get enlightened. This is one of the great teachings of the Buddha, but which is missed far too often. Too many people think that, you know, no pain, no gain. And that's not the way of Buddhism. It's no joy, no samadhi, no stillness. That is how the Buddha taught. So please don't be too ascetic. And it's always the case, even, you know, you're lay people and you think you're slack, you're not. You always tend to be far too tough on yourself. So that's, you know, I keep on saying that because I try and get you just to be in the middle path. So when, it's this great question, when your body is relaxed and comfortable, you can get into deep states of meditation, exactly. So part of meditation, the preparation, is finding how to get your body nice and relaxed and comfortable. And then meditation is so easy. What were the three mantras you said this morning? I don't know, what did I say this morning? I live in the present moment. Let go of the past. And what was Om Mani Padme Hum? You know the Om Mani Padme Hum, the Tibetan one. And Namo Tassa and Namo Buddhaya. Namo Buddhaya is very nice, that those from Indonesia, you know, that's the way they Theravada Buddhists greet each other. Because, you know, the Mahayanas say Amitofu to each other. Not tofu. Ami. Whatever it is. And Theravada say Namo Buddhaya, which just means, you know, homage to the Buddha. So that's what it really is. So those are the mantras this morning. Ajahn Brahm, I asked my mind whether it would prefer to watch the sunset or do walking meditation inside. Trouble is, I cannot tell whether it is my mind or my will which is answering. How do you distinguish between the mind and the will? You just ask the question and shut up and see what comes up. And as long as it's not you, you know, you just ask the question, I don't want to watch the sunset. And when you're mindful enough, you know, you just know this is what, you know, my mind wants to do. And you know you've got the right answer if you're nice and peaceful and comfortable. You don't feel tense anymore. So if you feel like nice and at ease and happy and no tension, then fine. You're answering what the mind wants to do. When it comes from you, an ego, nah, I want to get enlightened. Nah, watching the sunset is for cream puffs. Nah, I didn't come all this way from wherever you came, you know, just, you know, to watch sunsets. I can do that. Actually, you can't do that in Singapore. Too much pollution from Indonesia. I was there, you know, last month, and all these forest fires. So anyway, so, you know, if it comes from a sense of ego and sense of self, then it's willpower. But if it comes from wisdom power, then you feel very peaceful afterwards and realize it's a nice thing to do. What is the difference between Theravada, Mahayana and Tantrayana? Okay, Theravada is my Buddhism and that Mahayana and Tantrayana stuff, yeah. That's what some people could say. But that's rotten if you happen to be one of the other group. So Theravada is supposed to be the small vehicle. And I call it the humble vehicle. The simple vehicle. And small vehicles, number one, they are excellent, you know, for not emitting so many greenhouse gases. Big vehicles are really terrible. They contribute to climate change, all these big Mahayana vehicles. And number two, it's so hard to find parking space for big vehicles. So small vehicles are cool. So that's why I like small vehicle. They're very easy in the traffic. So somebody once told the joke, Mahayana is supposed to be big vehicle. Big vehicle, small vehicles, all vehicles will be towed away at the owner's expense. Which is actually quite nice. So, there's only one Buddha, so, you know, what is the difference here? Just people make these differences. You know, there's like different types of Buddhism. There's only one type of Buddhism. What is that Buddhism? Eightfold Path. And keep it Eightfold Path, keep it simple, that's what the Buddha taught. And forget about all this Mahayana, Tantrayana, and Mahayana and other yanas and stuff. It's all just the Buddhism. Because usually what happens, it's just, you know, it's just basically, it's ego. My Buddhism is better than your Buddhism. Ours is the fast way. Do you want to go the fast way? This is the fast way. Eightfold Path. But, you know, people are always competing with each other. And that's, I don't like competition. It should be cooperating. So these days, actually, many Theravadins, Mahayanas, actually, the Mahayanas and the Theravadas are, I'll be honest with you, are the best. We cooperate. You know, so Vajrayanas are the ones who don't usually cooperate very much. You know, and that's really quite, quite telling. So Mahayanas and Theravadas, we get on really well these days. That's why, you know, I founded this Australia Sangha Association. It's so easy to get the Mahayana monks and nuns together with the Theravada monks and nuns. We try and get a Vajrayana monk, and it's just so tough. So anyway, that's no real difference. Dear Ajahn, why do people who have NDE, that's near-death experiences, floating out of your body and be able to see interesting things? Why do people who have NDE often say they are not fearful of death anymore? Why do they see bright lights and experience unconditional love and practice meditation after an NDE? That is so easy to understand. Number one is, you know, this is what happens when you die. You know, your body stops, your five senses vanish, floating out of your body. That's what will happen when you really do die. So NDEs are just rehearsals, like practice sessions. So you know what's going to happen when you really do die. And so, number one, people who have NDEs always report it's a very pleasant experience. And the story I keep telling, it was on a documentary from the BBC. This English lady died on the operating table, floated out of her body, and was having such a wonderful time, you know, being out of the body in an NDE, that when she met this spirit who told her, no, your time is not up, you have to go back, she refused. She said, I'm not going back. I'm staying here. And the spirit said, but you have to go back. And she said, no way. And they had this big argument on the NDE plane. And she absolutely refused to go back to the old sick body until, you know, obviously she went back, that's why she could be interviewed, until she said the spirit somehow got hold of her and threw her back into her body against her will. And then when she got to that point in the interview, she screwed up her face and she was full of rage. She said, when I die next time, really die, I'm going to find that spirit and you wouldn't believe what I'm going to do to him. I'm going to bash him up, I'm going to scold him. What he did to me, sending me back to this old sick, you know, body, and I was just having such a lovely time when I'm dead. And I like telling that story because it shows you that, you know, after you get past the death experience, the rest is very beautiful. You know, dying is a problem, being dead is wonderful. So that's why, and I'm being quite accurate there, the process of dying can be very uncomfortable, but once you get past that point and you're dead, ooh, you're having a great time. So that is why that people who have those experiences, they're not afraid of death. They'd always be afraid of dying, but not of death. Why do they see bright lights and experience unconditional love? Because once the five senses disappear, and people see that light, this is what happens in meditation. It's the nimitta which I keep talking about. So when everyone will see the nimitta sooner or later. If you're not when you're meditating, at least when you're dead. So you're going to see it sooner or later, so don't worry. And so when you're meditating, you know, I'm saying everything gets very still and your five senses, they vanish. You know, you can't see, you can't hear. Even if somebody shouted, you won't be able to hear them. And then you know, you can't feel your body anymore, they can pick you up. If you get into these jhanas, just knowing it's a time for you to go back to Switzerland, we'll just put you in the aircraft and you won't know you're in the aircraft, and when you come to, you'll be back in Switzerland again. Easy, you wouldn't even know anything about it. That's true, you can't feel anything. But you're perfectly healthy, perfectly aware, perfectly safe. So that's actually what happens, your five senses disappear. When you get into these deep meditation sense states, five senses disappear and you see this beautiful light in your mind. Exactly the same light you see when you die. And if you can manage to get into that light, you get into the jhana realms. And when you're in the jhana realms, there's this incredible bliss. And what really fascinates me is just the way that people describe that bliss, you know, of the jhana states. And in the first jhana, often they describe it as pure love. Because ecstasy and pure love, when you're totally accepted, there's nothing wrong with you. It really is good enough. There's no criticism or judgment on you anymore. That's what people experience in these, you know, when they merge into this beautiful light, you know, in an NDE, or if they do it in meditation. So this, you can experience all this right here without having to die. It's much more convenient because it doesn't scare the hell out of your relations. You know, if you're in an operating table and you know you lose your heartbeat and your brain starts to stop working, people get very concerned. But here on a meditation retreat, you can do that with perfect safety. So it's exactly the same. So I often describe that when you do meditation in this style, it is learning how to die. This is dying lessons. Dying 101, otherwise known as Ajahn Brahm's retreat. Are you scared? It's wonderful to let go of this body. Dear Ajahn, you used to teach at the end of every meditation, enjoy the way you feel. What worked, what didn't. This is an almost automatic part of how I practice, though I focus more on what worked rather than what didn't. Recently, when you guide the meditation, I've noticed you only seem to focus on number one, not so much on the second reflection. Is there a reason? Is it okay? I still do both? Yeah, of course it's a reason you do both. You know, one of the reasons I do one day and another the other day, just, you know, to change things around a bit. I get very bored teaching the same meditation every time, again and again and again. So I like to swap it around, make it a little bit different every now and again. But both of those are really good. And the reason they're very good, at the end of your meditation, you know, you stop and you reflect. You know, what worked? And how do you feel? Because that way that you are noticing that there's no such thing as a bad meditation. It's one of the great insights I got from one of my first teachers. He said to me, there is no such thing as a bad meditation. What you take as a bad meditation, you know, is still better than not having meditated at all. You still get a little bit more peaceful, a little bit more centered. Even if you think it's a hopeless, it is actually quite good. And I started to notice that by asking at the end of every meditation how I felt, and I really noticed, yeah, it was actually an improvement. And I also wanted to know, just, you know, what did I do which worked, and why didn't it not work? What were my mistakes, and what were the things which were skillful means, which were very effective? So I learned by that process, you know, what the meditation is always really beneficial, and also I became very skilled in learning from what went wrong. But also learning for what went right, which is, again, far more effective to learn for what goes right. So that's how you learn. So it's still a very good thing to do. Feeling of death. Death comes up again. Is this an omen? We already mentioned about the meteorite or the asteroid hitting Earth. And this is the second question about death. And this is the third one about death. Is this an omen? Is something going to happen tonight? There are several old people on this retreat. Like me. Nah, you're not allowed to die. If you want to die on a retreat, now, if part of the rules is you have to ask permission from me, first of all. So I don't give permission on the retreat. It's just too much bother for poor old Bianca and Daniel to mess around with you. So please, you know, don't be selfish and die and cause all sorts of problems for other people. If you go and die on a retreat, I'll never allow you to come on a retreat again. Fear of death sometimes arises in my meditation. How should I handle it? I just do it. You know, just, you're going to die, just die. Stop being afraid of it. No, it's actually, the answer is good at the end here. Should I just say on that, should I just say, oh, that's good enough. At least I'm not dead yet. Excellent. So you get the fear of death and you say, yeah, well, not dead yet, so that's pretty good. So ahead of the game. There's sometimes the fear of death comes. We needn't be afraid of everything, just projecting onto the future. Come into the present moment. You're not dead yet. So, you know, when you die, you think about it then, but not now. Ajahn Brahm, a lot has been said about this month's astrological events, really, such as, we are moving into a new dimension of spiritual awakening. Half the population will be wiped out. Ooh. That's interesting. Can you explain what does this month, eclipses, meteor showers, and cardinal cross really mean? My gratitude. Okay, that's a lot of go, my young. They've been wonderful. This is my 63rd year, and the people have been saying that all this time, when I was really young, remember, people of my age, they had that musical Hair. We're moving into the age of Aquarius, an age of spiritual evolution And just after the age of Aquarius, we got Ronald Reagan, we got Tony Margaret Thatcher and Tony Blair. Where was the age of Aquarius? It got really lost somewhere. The Iraq wars and goodness knows what else. So it's a nice thought we're having a spiritual awakening, but you know, it's always much of the same. You know, that some people sort of, you know, they follow some spiritual awakening. Other people, they get into really strong materialism. Some people are cruel. Some people start terrorist organizations. And half of the population will never be wiped out. You know, there's always some people will die. A lot of more people get born. Now, what does this mean? Eclipses always are happening. Meteor showers, they're always there. I don't know what cardinal cross is. What's cardinal cross? I don't know. But anyway, basically, it's business as usual and always will be, unfortunately. Dear Ajahn, your noble silent tonic has magically prevented words of lies, intentional or unintentional, coming from mouths during retreat. Mental and physical something vices too. Is it really a layman's tonic in lieu of mindfulness only? No, that noble silence. You know, sometimes when we speak, sometimes we don't speak with enough care, which is one of the reasons why one of the sayings is, if you can't improve upon the silence, then don't speak. And a lot of times, a lot of chatter is just, you know, meaningless, you know, garbage, basically. We speak just for the sake of speaking. And most of the time, you know, what you say, hardly anyone is listening anyway. So the best thing to do is to be silent. And then if you're really, really silent, it's the old saying of the Buddha, that it is the great rivers which flow silently. The small streams make all the noise. It's a lovely saying, isn't it? So which do you want to be? The big, deep river which flows silently, or the small, superficial stream, always bubbling and saying stuff, like me? Well, I have to do this, it's my job. So it's nice to be quiet, and so sometimes you start to learn from noble silence just, you know, how foolishly we've talked when we didn't really need to. And it's amazing just how much friendship and bonding you have on this retreat with the people in the same cottage just by being there and just by a smile every, you know, every day or. And you can actually be so much friendly. And when you open your mouth, if you open your mouth too often, you're always going to eventually say something which people misunderstand and get offended by. And I still remember there was a couple, I think they're still around, I haven't seen them for a couple of years. There was a couple who had this almost perfect marriage. He was an Australian man who married a Thai girl. And he couldn't speak any Thai, and his wife couldn't speak any English. And they were so happy together. Absolutely true. They couldn't understand a word of what each other was saying. And they said, so they never got into an argument, not once. So, a lot of the time, isn't it nice that we don't talk so much? So noble silence is beautiful. And even though when you leave here you start speaking, but maybe you might not speak so much. Only when you really need to. Only when you can improve upon the silence.
Thoughts are relatively pleasant. Something and habitual. The present moment is not. I mean, not so pleasant, not habitual. It is so hard to bring the constantly something mind, talking mind, to the present and to the breath. How do I convince it to stay with the relatively unpleasant sensations of the present moment and not run to yet another soap opera of thoughts? I feel trapped. I want to analyze less and know more. That's a very good point, that sometimes the present moment is uncomfortable at first. But one of the nice things is, if you stay in the present moment long enough, it does become comfortable and it does become very pleasant. Now, trying to find a simile for this, I said, you know, that life is a journey, and sometimes that you find a stone bench to sit down on and rest So you're not going anywhere, you can just be in the present moment. But the stone bench is really cold and hard and uneven. But it's the only place you've got to stop. So you stop on it. And you find that as you sit on that stone bench longer and longer, it warms up, it becomes softer and it becomes even. And after a few minutes, it's incredibly comfortable. And that is like the simile, like the experience of coming into the present moment. When you first come into the present moment, it is a bit hard and cold and uneven. But hang out there, stay there for a while, and you will warm it up, it will soften for you. And after a few minutes, the present moment becomes very, very comfortable. And the reason is because you're not doing anything, because you're in the present moment, that degree of stillness will actually give energy to mindfulness. You start to see the beauty and the softness and the joy in it. Your mind will get happy, and you're happy with the present moment. You just have to hang out in there for a while, and then it becomes very present, very pleasant. Now, sometimes, you know, I'm getting old now, and sometimes my body is aching. And a lot of times when I meditate, not on this retreat because I'm really getting into it now, when I start meditating, my legs are aching or my back is aching or something is aching. But I've learned how to just to be with that. That's my present reality, you know, the aches and pains in the body. That is the object of my present moment awareness. I stay with that. It's only about 3 or 4 minutes. And then everything relaxes, you know, the pains, the aches vanish, and I'm just having a wonderful time. But I know that the first time I come into the present moment, it is a little bit unpleasant. But I know if I can just hang out there for a little while, it gets more and more pleasant by the minute, until it's a very wonderful place to stay. So, please hang out there in the present moment. And it will change, and it will become very, very delightful for you. Otherwise, you'll always be going off into thinking and to, as you say, the soap operas of the mind. Dear Ajahn, please could you give some tips on how to combine breath meditation with metta to brighten and gladden the mind to the max? Metta meditation is this beautiful, like, loving kindness, where you care for something and you give it some compassion and kindness. For those of you who've gone over to Bodhinyana Monastery for lunch, you know, because you don't fancy the food here, you know, you can go and have a look to see what's on, and I don't like that, so you walk to Bodhinyana Monastery, which some of you have been doing. It's okay, you're most welcome to. You will find that there's a couple of kangaroos who hang out, you know, No, and all the visitors, they go photographing themselves with the kangaroos. When I go down there, I realise they're not interested in photographing me anymore. They like the cuddly kangaroo. So there's a couple of kangaroos there. They're posing every day now for photographs. And of course, you know, they also get fed. And that's why they're there, because people are kind to them and give them something to eat. That's why they keep coming. And it's very nice to have these beautiful kangaroos. When you're kind to them, they hang around. Just like your breath. If you can be kind to your breath, just like people are kind to those kangaroos, they will hang around. And your breath won't disappear, it will just stay there. So you can get all these beautiful photographs, you know, of the kangaroos, photographs of your breath. It's just there for however long you want. Just that simple kindness. So you can start looking at your breath, you know, like a being. Now, it's called anthropomorphize. You put like a life into that being. Just like you have loving kindness sometimes towards your car. You even give it a name. People do that to their cars. And, or even to your computers. I've done that for such a long time, and it actually works. If you give loving kindness to a machine, it works much better. And I did this, you know, with the old cement mixer which we had, you know, when we first came to Bodhinyana Monastery. That was my cement mixer. I was the main builder. And absolutely true, other monks could not get it to work. It would not work for them. And I would just go up to it, and I'd actually stroke it. There you go. Now, these other monks, they don't care for you, but I do. Nice cement mixer. Pull the cord, it will work every time. Have you ever had experiences like that? You know, sometimes people told me that their car would not work, and they went up to it, and they were kind to it, and it worked. Somebody told me, I think, on the last retreat, that they were working in an office and a photocopier was bust. So someone had put a sign on it, you know, out of order. But the sign had actually fallen down. So he went up to it and he was saying, oh, nice photocopier. You don't mind doing a few photocopies for me? And it worked perfectly for him. And people couldn't believe it worked for him. And the best story, it's in the Good, Bad, Who Knows book. And as we were going through it, Venerable Kimbler said, it is actually true. Did it actually happen? And it did happen. One of the people who came to stay in Bodhinyana Monastery for 1 year, he went back to Germany to study. And when the first day he was on campus at this university somewhere in Germany, the first day he went past an ATM machine. And he heard a noise from the ATM machine. He called it a gurgling noise. And he interpreted that as the ATM welcoming him into the university. And so, you know, he actually was kind to the ATM afterwards. He always said hello and guten Morgen to the ATM machine. And, you know, he gave it loving kindness. You know, may you be happy and well. May you never run out of money. May people not hit you when they find there's nothing left in their bank balance. You know, he was always really kind to it. And he said after 3 or 4 months, you know, in that campus, he was having his lunch on a bench within a few meters of that ATM machine. You know, he could see it. No one had been close to the ATM machine for at least 15 minutes when the ATM machine gurgled again. And as he looked at it, after it gurgled, a 20 euro banknote came out of the machine. No one had put in the card. No one had pressed any buttons. It just came out. So he went up to it, took it out, waved it around. Does this belong to anybody? No one claimed it, so he put it in his pocket. That's what happens when you're kind. The ATM machines are kind back to you. Try that. So if you can be kind to a machine, and I've done that to machines, being kind to them, stroke them, you know, be chant at them. I was just arrived in Oslo the last time I was up in Norway. And just, you know, out of the airport, and I had to rush to go to a talk, and the boom gates were stuck in the car park. And all these people were out, you know, of their cars and they're swearing and trying to call up somebody to try and get the boom gate to open up. And what did Ajahn Brahm do? Nice boom gate. Now may you be happy and well. And it opened up straight away. My driver, he was really impressed. So you're asking. So this is what you can do, you know, when it gets to a machine. So how about doing that to your breath? Oh, nice breath. Oh, thank you. You've been looking after me ever since I was born, coming in and going out, even though I'm not paying any attention to you. Even when I'm sleeping, I'm sick. You know, you've always brought oxygen into me and always taken these waste products out. Thank you so much, breath. You've been so kind to me, serving me without stopping. Thank you so much. I really like you, breath. And as soon as you look at the breath like that, it becomes so pleasant to look at. And you just watch your nice little breath for hours and hours and hours. Just like you can actually, you know, have a cat on your lap and stroke it for hour after hour after hour. So it's very pleasant when you give it loving kindness. So if you give loving kindness to your breath becomes very pleasant. And then you're just watching your breath, and just no effort needed at all. So see if you can anthropomorphize and look upon your breath like a being you've neglected for such a long time. So be kind. Breath, you can come in whichever way you want, slow or fast. It's up to you now. And I really care for you, breath. Thank you so much. You're so sweet and so nice to me. And then it's so easy to get into deep meditation. Dear Ajahn Brahm, what is the importance of jhana? Jhana is the way to become enlightened. That's how important it is. And without jhana, there is no enlightenment. And that's, again, in the Mahamalunkya Putta Sutta, number 64. It says you cannot be enlightened without jhanas. No more than you can get to the heartwood of a tree without going through the bark and the sapwood. That was the simile the Buddha gave. You've got to get to the heartwood, the pith of a tree. And how can you get to that without going through the bark and the sapwood? You have to go through those things to get to the, you know, the pith, the heartwood. And so just like you have to go through jhanas to get to enlightenment. There's no other way. So said the Buddha. But of course, when I first heard that simile, to get to the heartwood of a tree without going through the pith and the bark, I thought of all sorts of, now how can you do this? Maybe you can go through the root. Right, into the end of the root. Or maybe you go through the leaves and the twigs or whatever. And you always think of trying some ways around these things. And just like jhana, we always want to find our way around it so I don't have to get into jhanas. But, you know, fortunately there's no other way. That is why the jhana is the eighth factor of the Eightfold Path. It's jhanas, it always is. It's always defined that way, always explained that way. Samma Samadhi, it's jhanas. So, you know, you have to do the Eightfold Path to become enlightened. You have to need jhanas to become enlightened. That's why we teach jhanas, so you can become enlightened. So that's its importance. It's fundamental. Dear Ajahn Brahm, last night you said we should read the fine line of how we should die. I see how we die as karma for those loved ones left behind. Am I right? I think I said read the fine lines of when you're born, of what you're letting yourself in for. But anyway, I see how we die as karma for those loved ones left behind. I'm right. You know, not really, because your loved ones, they make their own karma with what you, with when you die. So sometimes, you know, when you die, do your loved ones have to get upset? Or is it their choice? Are you causing them grief and pain and suffering when you die? Or are they causing it for themselves? You know, a lot of times it is they cause it for themselves. When they say, oh, don't die, I'll be so sad. I mean, that's your choice to be sad or to let it go, to be wise. And you all know that simile which I developed after my father died. Life is like a concert. All concerts will end one day. And when they do end, all the concerts I ever went to, I never cried after the great performances. When the concert was over, I felt grateful, privileged to have been there in some of the most amazing orchestras and bands. I was there and I heard that. That was such a wonderful experience. Yeah, it was over and I wouldn't hear it again, but I wouldn't miss that for the world. That's how I felt when my father died. It's when my mother died as well a couple of years ago. What a wonderful time we had together. Thank you so much. No tears. A sense of joy and happiness. I had such a great people as my parents. You don't have to cry and feel sad when your loved one dies. That is your choice. So, when you die, you're not causing other people bad karma. It's their choice whether to look at your death with wisdom or whether to look at it with stupidity and cause a lot of suffering for themselves. So it's their karma, it's not yours. The one who dies, that's all they do. Obviously, a tragic and painful death leaves a lot more suffering to those left behind than someone who had a long, healthy life. No, it's just both. A long, healthy life. You can't have a long and healthy life. The longer you live, the more chance of being sick. And I've never seen a person who is old who is healthy. Because this is what happens to you when you get old. You know, when you get old, you know, you lose your sight. You know, you need glasses. You can't hear very well. You need hearing aids. You know, your hands start to shake, and you know, your legs are very weak. You have to help people lift them off the ground, off the floor. Sometimes, you know, you need these Zimmer frames to walk. That's what happens when you get old. When you get old, everything gets weak except for one thing. The one thing which gets stronger with age, your mouth. Old people can really talk. Eyes go, ears go, hands go, legs go, but their mouth always gets stronger every year. Anyhow. So, a tragic and painful death. Yeah, painful deaths are not very nice. But, you know, a lot of times it's a great way of overcoming the pain of death, the physical pain. It's the mental pain which people find it hard to deal with. And that is something which Dhamma, meditation, can help you with. The mental pain. And that mental pain, the Buddha once said, even though the body is sick, the mind doesn't need to be sick. Even though physically you may be in discomfort, there's no reason why the mind should be in discomfort. And you can see that many times. Some people are just amazing people. They're in great pain, but they're happy, peaceful. And those are the people who realize they are wise. That's often the time when you know that, so, you know, the monk has been practicing properly, the nun has been practicing properly. Not they can just sit there and look very enlightened. But, you know, but when they're suffering, when they're about to die, that's usually the time you can understand what they've been doing all this life. If they can die with peace, you know, without being too upset, then you know that they know how to let go. And you can do that. Okay, just little similes, little stories. My toothache, years and years and years ago. I had this terrible, terrible, terrible toothache. No way could I meditate, no way could I sleep. I was up about 2 o'clock in the morning, and it was just my whole mouth was exploding with pain. In the jungles of Thailand, no telephone or electricity anywhere, no dentist for about 30 kilometers, and just I was desperate. And I tried everything I could possibly do to get rid of this terrible, terrible pain. Until after a while, I was only a young monk, stupid. After a while I decided, what would my teacher say? And he would tell me to just let go. And so I actually did that, I let go. And that was one of the first times I really let go. Because immediately, no, not even a second, once I let go, the pain vanished. It was one of those amazing experiences. My mum, you had incredible pain, you couldn't sleep, and you couldn't meditate, you couldn't do anything. Just incredible pain in your mouth. And the next moment, it was just not there at all. You just blissed out. And that's one of the first times I realized the power when you can really, really let go. The worst pains can vanish. That's what happens. Physically, you can't do much about it, but mentally, you can do so much about it. And I read afterwards, and they said that about 99% of what we take as pain is mental. Only about 1% is physical. And that's why I was telling people in the Penang retreat that when we were in Thailand, in our monastery there, so over 35 years ago, we had a book about how to give birth to kids. And people wondered, what are you doing, a bunch of men, in a monastery in Thailand with a midwifing book? And the reason was it was written by these bunch of hippies, you know, in the United States. They formed a commune, and one of the things they were really, really very successful at was teaching their women in the commune how to give birth without any pain. And, you know, there was doctors there, and they sort of said this was actually happening. Number one, they never called it labor pain, they called it labor energy. And they brainwashed them from the time they got pregnant. This is going to be an incredible experience. You know, this is going to be the force of creation, of birth, is going to flow through your body. Don't resist it, don't fight it. Just go totally with it. Let it be. And had all these incredible experiences of women describing their births without any pain at all. And I thought that was just, you know, just a weird book we had in our library. But it came up again. Somebody mentioned it became a classic. You know, in midwifery, which they refer to. There's a bunch of hippies just, you know, changed the game about giving birth. And so many women actually gave birth without any pain or painkillers at all. And that's why the reason we had it was actually giving an example of how you can let go and pain vanishes. You don't call it pain. That's why if any of you are doctors or nurses and you're giving someone an injection and say, this is going to hurt. I don't say that, for goodness sake. This is going to hurt. Then it does. Now just give them something. This is just going to be just an incredible feeling which is going to come up. That's what it is. But don't call it pain, because that makes it painful. So actually that is this, what was the question anyway? Anyway, somewhere down there. Next question. Dear Ajahn Brahm, can we reach enlightenment if we are married? No, you have to get divorced before you become enlightened. Of course you can become enlightened when you're married. Can you elaborate into why some of us are desperate to get married and some don't care? Is it being desperate is a problem here? Don't be desperate to get married. If it happens, it happens. If it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen. Don't be desperate. So if you're not married yet, go and talk to someone who is. And that will change your mind. And if you are married already, just make the best of it. It's not sort of all bad. So some people like getting married and they want to try that. I told some people that, you know, that was actually just about a week ago. You know, the people who bought Udana today, the food today. And I went to see their son who was engaged to another girl, and I was teaching them about marriage. And they asked that question, is this hindering my spiritual path? Is it being selfish, getting married, just thinking about myself? And I said, absolutely not. Because, you know, when you get married, it's that simile I gave, you can never think of yourself, you should never think of your partner. In a marriage, you can only think of us. It's not about him or her, it's not about me, it's about us. Which means you have to actually sacrifice, your own desires when you get married. You know, don't sacrifice for him. Don't sacrifice for her. Don't sacrifice for me. Sacrifice for us. And there's a lot of letting go in that marriage. Because I was wondering, why is it that when people get married, why do they want, religious people to be part of their ceremony? Why do they give it this spiritual aspect to marriage? Now, isn't it just a sort of a secular ceremony? You ask people to get married and say, absolutely no, there is a spiritual side to it. What is that? And there is like that sense of sacrifice and commitment to something much bigger than your sense of self. And that is the part of letting go, which is an important part of a marriage. So if you do it well, it can be a sort of, a step into letting go a little bit more. Obviously, there's a lot of attachment in that marriage as well, and that's usually the problem there. But there's also a lot of letting go as well into a marriage. So that's why, like anything else in life, it's how you do it, not really what it is. If you do it marriage well, then maybe you can actually make a lot of progress. But of course, part of the enlightenment is having no attachments at all. And when you have those no attachments, you can tell your love goes to a bigger level. And that's when it goes to that level of, the opening the door of your heart story. Can you tell, your partner, your wife, your husband, darling, the door of my heart is open to you no matter what you ever do. My love for you is unconditional. And if you can do that, then your marriage has gone to a much higher level. It's almost very spiritual now, a marriage of letting go. You love the partner no matter what they ever do. And I always say the test of that, if you think your relationship with your wife, with your husband has got to that level, imagine you go home after this retreat and you find your partner has run away to Bali with your best friend for a dirty, sexy week. How would you feel? If you really had that spiritual love to your partner, if you really had opened the door of your heart to them, that your happiness is the most important thing for me, darling, you'd be overjoyed that your wife is having much better sex with your best friend than she ever had with you. Oh, I'm so happy for you, darling. You're having such a wonderful time. Your happiness is the most important thing in the world for me. Oh, so joy, you're having great sex with my best friend instead of me. Or would you be really pissed off and fed up and just, I'm going to divorce her, she can't do that to me. A lot of people can't have that unconditional love. Sometimes there's too much ego, too much pride involved in a marriage. So if you can do it really well, maybe you can have this beautiful, you know, your happiness, darling, is most important for me. Can you do that? Then it's a spiritual marriage which is taken on to a much higher level. And a lot of times, while you're desperate to get married, and some don't care, many of you are still conditioned by the fact that if you don't get married, there must be something wrong with you. That's unfortunate. You know, you get peer pressure to get married. And that's a terrible, terrible thing. You know, they say we should have that choice. And it's a wonderful thing in our modern age. Everybody now has that choice, to get married or not get married. And the pressure on you is not that strong anymore. And if you don't get married, you don't have to become a monk or a nun. You can just be a single person. And now you are respected and you can actually survive pretty well. 20, 30, 40 years ago, or even today in some societies, if you don't get married, your parents give you hell. You know, they really say, now come on, you know, get married. If you don't find a partner, I'll find one for you. But nowadays that's not there. So the peer pressure is gone, which is brilliant. So people can choose to be single and have a wonderful time. Okay, that's the other one now. Okay, only a couple more questions and I'll finish. Ajahn Brahm, you said something about getting into politics and fought for a Buddhist country. Not fought for a Buddhist country, am I right? No. A country isn't Buddhist. A person isn't Buddhist, not a country. I've never seen a country take the three refuges and the five precepts. I've never seen a country shave its head and wear brown. You know, it's... people can be Buddhist or Christian. I really sort of object to say that this is an Islamic country, or this is a Buddhist country, or a Christian country. That's ridiculous. Countries aren't Buddhist. People are. And you never find a country with 100% anything. So, not getting into politics, just in order to help, you know, any sort of country, any government, make use of these great Buddhist wisdom and techniques of compassion and forgiveness and kindness, because the world sorely needs this. And obviously non-materialism, understanding there's more to life than just, you know, the economic performance of a government. And if more Buddhists got involved in some politics, I think we'd have a much softer and, you know, maybe just a more effective political system, where other things are much more important than just, you know, your salary. You know, the old Bhutanese, you know, gross national happiness instead of gross national product. You know, at least that's a start, that's a Buddhist government. And making sure that happiness is more important than economic output. You know, that gives us hope for this world. So why can't more Buddhists actually contribute to the governance of our countries? And maybe that our governance would be much better. Maybe we wouldn't be so keen to go to wars. Maybe we wouldn't put so much money into armaments and military and more into, like, you know, aid or disabilities and stuff. I don't know. But anyway, I think that it'd be wonderful if there were more Buddhists in our parliaments. Okay, that's politics. And how does one do that? What is the first step to get into it? And who does one get to access in order to start it off? I am keen. How to have a go? Please advise. Thank you. Okay, we can start the Buddhist Party of Australia. Is that a good or Buddhist organization? No. What can we call it? The Buddhist Party? The Australian Buddhist Party? What? Australia Buddhist Political Care? No. Whatever, anyway, you know, you can get the name later on. But just no group of people, if you join an ordinary existing party or actually start another party yourself, you know, and just whatever it is, but keep really strong ethical principles. You know, and if you can do that, it'd be wonderful. Anyway, I used to do what you call zombie walking meditation, only walking very slowly without biting people. Oh, biting people. That's zombies. They bite people, don't they? They eat brains or something. I don't know. I don't know what zombies are. I haven't been in the world for a long time. So I used to do what you call zombie walking meditation, only walking very slowly without biting people. This gives me much more details and time to absorb my walking motions. You seem saying it is not good to walk too slowly. Why? I find that I have better awareness and more peaceful mind when doing walking meditation very slowly. Can I still do that? It's okay if it's natural. But a lot of times people force themselves to walk slowly. And I've seen that on these walking meditation paths. People have a competition to see who can walk the slowest. So if the other person gets to the end before you, they think, ugh. Or rather, you know, they get there after you. So you try, it's not about competition. So if you are walking in any of those rooms, you just walk the natural pace. And don't worry whether it's slow or fast. As long as you're enjoying it and it's working for you, that is fine. But it does remind me of the other story, which about walking meditation. It was happened in England when the monks first went to a monastery in Sussex in England. And there was one supporter, she was a psychiatrist who was interested in the mind and in meditation, so she went to the monastery, became a member of the support group. And when the monk said, we want to do a meditation retreat somewhere, but where can we hold the retreat? She said, why not come into my house? Because she bought this old mansion in a village, you know, with stables and a big hall. He said, you can use up my house for the weekend to do a meditation. And, you know, it didn't take much to sort of clean up the place and put some mattresses down, and that was a little weekend meditation retreat. Now, this was an English village in Sussex. And so when people started doing their walking meditation in the garden, you know, the local villagers, they're always, you know, they're called nosy, looking through the windows, what's going on? They saw all these people walking very slowly in the garden. And they knew that this was a psychiatrist's house who worked in the local hospital for the mentally infirm. And they asked, it's absolutely true. You know, they thought that she'd brought her patients home for the weekend. And one of the villagers actually rang the police. And the police came to this house to round up all the meditators and take them back to the mental hospital. And it took a lot of convincing the police that these weren't mentally infirm, these were just Buddhists. And that happened years ago. So that's one of the reasons. If you are doing the slow walking meditation, don't do it in public. You will get put in a van and taken away. In here it's fine. If it works, brilliant, just do it. Can you share with us on the technique of Om Mummy, Penny Hong. Om Mani, Padme Hum. So anyway, that is just, I think I mentioned it enough already this morning. Om Mani, Padme Hum. You recite it to yourself over and over and over again. Because when you recite it to yourself, it means you can't be thinking of anything else. It's a way of focusing the mind. And then you put spaces between the words. Om, Mani, Padme, Hum. The length of space depends on you, but put a small space first of all. And then after you've done a small space, you know, for a minute or two, then you can lengthen the space. Om, Mani, Padme, Hum. And as you lengthen the space, you have silence. And if thoughts come up, you close the space down. You go back to Om, Mani, Padme, Hum. Hardly any space at all. That way you crowd the thought out. And as you settle down, you can put the spaces in again and lengthen them and lengthen them. That way you can adjust that method to suit just how quiet your mind is. If it's a very restless mind, you have to, you know, open up the spaces very slowly. But sooner or later, you calm down enough. You have to calm down enough, and you can start putting the spaces in and lengthening them and lengthening them and lengthening them until you have so long spaces that you have silence. It's a great way of getting silent awareness by doing the Om Mani Padme Hum. And it doesn't have to be Om Mani Padme Hum. As I said earlier, it can be any set of words, you know, Namo Buddhaya, but then it's, you know, with the syllables, Namo Buddhaya. Yeah, five syllables. So that way you can actually put spaces, and it's a great way to, you start to appreciate the silence between the words, and that's brilliant. The last question. Oh, it's not a question. It is praise. So I should have actually mentioned, if you have any complaints about this retreat, please go and see Bianca at the back, or Dania, she's in the hall over there. So the complaints go over there. Any compliments, please come here. No, any complaints as well. They have, the retreat rocks. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you to all fellow meditators and helpers. So that looks like my writing. No, it's somebody else's writing. So thank you for the nice compliment there. And I hope the retreat is rocking, and I hope you're having a nice time. It's only, what is it, the third day, the fourth day? I don't know how many days have gone, how many days are to come, but who cares anyway? There's lots of time left. So please just go very slowly, always in the present moment. Don't be a prisoner of time. Don't even look what time it is. If you feel energy, then carry on meditating. If you feel tired, go and rest. Whatever time you get up in the morning, that's what Ajahn Chah used to teach me. He said, when you wake up in the morning, just get out of bed first, and then look at the clock. You know what happens, you look at the clock, oh, 3 o'clock, oh no, and you go back to sleep again. Instead of doing that, you get up, yeah, and you look at the clock, oh dear, 3 o'clock, but I'm up now anyway, so you carry on meditating, it becomes natural. You can always go to bed again afterwards. But you know, get up first, and then look at the clock, it's much, much better. So you're not a prisoner of time so much. And then, just doesn't matter how long you sleep, you know, if you don't sleep long tonight, you can always sleep a bit longer tomorrow night or in the afternoon. And anyway, you can always catch up on your sleep when you're in your coffin. You can sleep as long as you like in your coffin. So that way you can enjoy yourself. If you've got energy and happiness, carry on meditating. If you want to go for a walk or have a cup of tea or coffee, you know, the restaurant is open at all hours of the day. Sort of, not restaurant, is it, but tea and coffee are always available, or juice or other stuff. So just enjoy yourself and have a wonderful evening. And I'll see some of you tomorrow morning. Not all of you, obviously, because I know the only reason why you're not all here for the morning is because you probably meditate till 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. Isn't that the case? Okay, just my wishful thinking. So have a good night.